Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Parents of college-age students used to complain about the empty nest syndrome, feeling lonely and abandoned when the kids moved away. Now many parents have the opposite problem. Their children are returning home after college and staying at home, often for many years after graduation. Much of the media coverage and public debate on the Generation Y's failure to launch blames young people for taking longer to grow up, as though the fault is of their own doing. Our guest today has a different take, and he says it's all not such a bad thing in a more complex world to have young people stay home longer. Richard Sederston is director of the Hallie Ford Center for Healthy Children and Families at Oregon State University, where he teaches human development and family sciences. He is also a member of the MacArthur Research Network on Transitions to Adulthood, and he's the co-author of a new book, Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann.
The schedule that youth follow to arrive at adulthood changes to meet different eras, and we're in a different era now. Is that right?
Yeah, we are. I mean, when you think about major milestones of adulthood, things like leaving home, finishing school, finding work, getting married, having kids, those are markers that we've always thought about as being kind of big sociological markers of the attainment of adulthood. And well, just a few decades ago, of course, those things were pretty lockstep, and it now takes young people much longer to achieve those things, if ever, and the routes into them and through them are much more complicated.
614-292-8513, that's the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. To our listeners, we'd love to hear your stories, the good, the bad, and the ugly, if you will, of having your children return home or being one of those children or having done that. And if you want to talk about that situation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, because that's what we're talking about today. When did the change start to occur? When did it start to be okay? Because back in my day, I couldn't wait to get out. I would live in utter, almost abject poverty to be out of the house. Well, and I don't know. It's partly relational, isn't it? It's kids have different sorts of relationships with their parents than maybe we did back in the day.
Yeah, there are two really big things that have changed in the last couple of decades. I mean, first, the economy has changed in a big way, and of course, it now takes young people much longer to find jobs that allow them to live independently, let alone raise a family on. And it takes a lot more resources economically to get launched, especially when you think about the costs of school, higher education, the cost of living, the cost of housing. And you're right, the second big factor would really be about the relationships that parents and kids today have, which are dramatically different from just a few decades ago. Of course, families are, and especially parents and kids, are much closer and more connected than they've been before. And and so those two factors, among other things, have really tilted in ways that totally changed the landscape of early adult life.
My guest is Richard Sederston. He is co-author with Barbara E. Ray of the book Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. If you have an example of why it's good or why it's bad that your children or you are still living at home, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Now, the thing we most think back on is the 1950s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Families then, that kind of set this tone for the way we think kids should be behaving today.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is, I guess, the point you were getting at a second ago, and that is that this kind of quick start model to adult life really emerged after World War II. Again, this fast start, lockstep life, and it was really possible then. Opportunities were plentiful. And as you noted, social conventions really reinforced the quick start. I mean, it would have been horrifying to live at home with your parents mm-hmm. in the decades after the war. But I think in some ways what we're seeing now leaves young people looking a lot more like their counterparts in the early part of the last century. I mean, the first few decades of the 1900s, which had a much longer course where you saw much greater multi-generational living and a much more stuttered start to adult life. And I think it's important that we recognize that each generation really does come of age in its own time, and that time does leave its imprint, and what was true of one can't easily be applied to the next.
You wrote that young people are taking longer to achieve economic and psychological autonomy than their counterparts did back then. The economic is understandable. The economy is something is easy to measure and understand. Why the psychological?
Yeah, I think this does come about in part because of, again, about the new kind of relationship that parents and young people have. I mean, new kinds of young people don't just come about out of the blue, right? They're also actively parented by new kinds of parents, and that's really changed. I mean, parents now make extraordinary investments, especially in the middle class and higher, both emotional and financial, in their kids from the time they're little, and these things now continue into the early adult years for many families. Parents and kids today are also surprisingly more aligned on values. That decreases in a way the kind of generation gap between them. I think there are all kinds of reasons at play here, but the bottom line is that the support of parents is really crucial in getting kids launched today. It's probably, in our society, the single most important factor. And we're not just talking about financial support. Again, we're talking about emotional and other kinds of practical support as well.
Kathleen from Columbus, you have a different take on it. Welcome to the show.
Well, yes, I do, and I really am enjoying this show. I wanted to say that when I got married some years ago, my mother, who had raised five girls, said, "Do not think you're coming home with your children. I am not going to raise them," which, of course, I never did. But I find it so interesting that you remarked that things are changing now because, golly gee, I would no more have wanted my mother raising my children than flying over the moon, but she was afraid, based on what was happening with her friends, that this is what my expectation would be.
Hmm.
Yeah, that is interesting. It's probably you're talking mostly, Rick, about people coming home from college and not leaving for a while, but Kathleen's bringing up the issue of people bringing their children home to live with their parents as well.
Yeah, that's actually, I think that's emerging as an issue, especially in today's economy. It's not been so typical. The return home after college is becoming rather normative in middle-class families, and the evidence is really suggesting that, again, especially in today's economy, it can be a really good thing. It doesn't go on for years. I think that's another really important factor to keep in mind. If kids come back, they normally come back to regroup. They're thinking strategically, especially once they have college degrees, about job choices and relationship choices. But they're not staying there for the long haul. I mean, most of that action is sort of gone by the late 20s, and it really marches downward and almost evaporates by 30.
Yeah, mm-hmm. My son did that briefly for a couple of years, and he's now out on his own with his own household and his partner, and all I can say is it was a pleasure to have him, especially with the passing of his father. My son turned out to be an amazing rock, along with his sister, in helping me, so there was a wonderful point.
That's the upside.
And I'd love to comment on that. I think it's really important. We can't just assume that when kids are at home, that it's about, or just about, anyway, the kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can be really beneficial for parents, too. It's a two-way street. I think many parents, like your caller, today's parents, often take pleasure in having kids there, even if they're worried about whether they'll ultimately get launched. But, this is especially true once kids are older. Often the co-residence with a parent is more about the parent than the kid. And that's important to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. And I learned to play dominoes with my son, and he's a killer at dominoes.
Kathleen, thanks for your call.
Thank you. This is a pleasure. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. One of your findings is that few 20-somethings who live at home are mooching off their parents, as it's put here.
Yeah, we're, you know, we're really not seeing, I heard before the show you played that clip from the Failure to Launch movie with Matthew McConaughey. Yeah, I think we're not seeing that kind of kid, basically, kid.
they were 30-something.
Yeah, exactly, with a beautiful girlfriend. You know, we're not talking about spoiled and coddled kids who are taking advantage of their parents and who are refusing to grow up. I mean, what we're really showing is that these are young people who are treading hard to get ahead, and in many cases, living at home can be a really smart economic decision, especially if it allows young people to, say, be in school when they otherwise might not be able to afford it, if it allows them to be in a low-paid or no-pay apprenticeships or internships that are going to help them on the market, you know, if it allows them to save for a stronger launch when they do go. And again, especially in today's economy, it can be a smart economic strategy to build that nest egg in a way and to launch from the strongest point possible. You know, what we fail to recognize is that living at home today actually keeps a whole lot of young people out of poverty. And there the statistics are remarkable, and it's important to keep that in mind. That's a good thing.
If you want to give us a call and join the conversation, you're welcome. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Ken from New Albany, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good show. I not only have experience with young adults living in my home, but also I have a company and employ young adults. And a lot of them live in their parents' house. And some of them have been recently divorced and they no kids, so they moved in with their parents again, et cetera. A lot of the young adults that I talk to are not there because they want to be there. They're there because the economics are such they either can't find a job or they got graduated from college and they can't find a job. So this is the alternative. Having said that, I think that I think there's some positives there because the kids do get to learn how to manage your money now if they've gone through difficulties because of bankruptcy or because of divorce. Now the household is basically you get a chance to restart. So it's not really that they weren't launched. They were launched, but they crashed. And now they need a landing pad to reboot and regroup. But the economics part is definitely what's driving this in what I see, because people can't offer these kids who are graduating from college jobs, or if they offer them the jobs, the incomes are not what they used to be. That's where I'm gonna just listen to your conversation some more, but I wanted to give you that input that I have experienced and I've seen how this happens, and it's amazing that that's becoming part of our culture. Whether it's good or not, I'm not sure. It's just a fact of the matter that this is what we're going through.
Thank you, Ken.
I appreciate your show. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Can we hold that for Rick, talk about that when we come back from a break?
Sure.
Okay, great. My guest is Richard Satterston. He's co-author of a book about young adults who stay at home. It's called Not Quite Adult, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. If you have an example of this in your life, please give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And, you know, you can always go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if that is your preferred mode of communication. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And at 2 o'clock this afternoon, join us for Talk of the Nation. President Obama insists the mission in Libya is clear and focused, and after more than a week of airstrikes, succeeding. House Speaker John Boehner, among others, disagrees. Is the goal to protect civilians or regime change? How long will it take, and how does it end? Join host Neil Conan for reaction to the president's speech on Libya. That's today at 2 on Talk of the Nation on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment consultants helping clients achieve financial independence through professional planning at sherringtongroup.com.
It's 33 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today and a high near 48. Cloudy skies tonight, a low of 29 degrees, and a high of 45 for tomorrow with cloudy skies. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Richard Setterston. He is co-author with Barbara Ray of the book Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. If you have an example of that in your life, we welcome your call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rick, you know, young adults who aren't making enough money to live on their own can also live with other young adults. I mean, that's kind of, you know, a way to make things work. Is that less popular now, or is it that the economics are such that even that isn't going to cut the mustard?
Well, no, actually, I mean, one of the really remarkable things about today is that despite all this talk about living at home longer or coming back home later, a hallmark of the early adult years today is that you're living without a spouse, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that time is then getting filled in to a much greater degree with friendships, for example, and with family relationships in new forms. But what we're seeing today is that the living arrangements of young people are extraordinarily diverse. I mean, we kind of latch on to and obsess about living at home, but actually, many young people are living in all kinds of configurations. The main thing to keep in mind is they're not living with a spouse.
Okay.
That's the key shift.
They're delaying marriage by and large, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, until much later in the 20s, and delaying childbearing, too. And it's there that we do find that slower course, especially around marriage and parenting, ends up being a really good thing. But you know, mm-hmm. to the point of your prior caller, mm-hmm. you asked me to comment on mm-hmm. that. I think, you know, in other countries where living at home has been much more commonplace, there's really no stigma around it. I mean, whether it's about cultural norms, so in Italy, for example, it's really quite expected that young people stay at home until they marry.
Mm-hmm.
In places where the economy, and especially housing markets, make it difficult for young people to live independently, you see multi-generational living in very high proportions, and it's not a big deal. I think in our society, again, it kind of grows out of that period after World War II where, leaving home became the traditional marker of independence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the economy at the time and the conventions at the time really pushed young people out. And we're seeing that being reconfigured today. We're in a special historical moment again where we're thinking in new ways about what it means to be independent and in ways that don't involve leaving home. The other comment that your caller made is really it's important to keep in mind that the recession didn't suddenly cause this.
Mm-hmm.
I think the recession has really heightened a set of patterns that have been in the works for a couple of decades, and a lot of the action around living at home longer or coming back really started in the 80s. It's just grown now in light of the economy, but it's not a new thing. I think what the economy does is it takes some of the shame out of it in our society, because people can point at forces that are sort of out there that change the options in front of them, and those are real. But it's safer because they don't have to point inside to say there's something wrong with me or there's something wrong with my child. There's comfort in the recession.
Adam from Columbus, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just had a comment on the influence that new technologies are having with the way that parents are able to kind of interject into the lives of young adults. I'm 23 myself, living in Columbus on my own, and it's just a lot easier for parents to have an up-to-date, very kind of nuanced understanding of what they're going through, what their child is going through, and you couple that with this mindset these days of a very tumultuous and unstable
Yeah, there's no question. Every generation kind of comes of age in its own technological time, and become key drivers of new kinds of technology. And the whole digital world in front of us is transforming all of our lives, right? Not just the lives of young people. And as your caller's pointing out, it's also transforming the ways in which parents and children, little children too, communicate. Again, whether this is good or bad is a kind of open empirical question yet, in terms of the legacy that the immersion in digital technology has on young people. But I think the main thing is it's a key way to get engaged in relationships. It's a key way to get engaged in civic and political life. It's about exposure to information, and information is power. I mean, it's really become digital technologies have really become critical in creating opportunities.
On the other side of that, is it really possible to kind of cut the ties, cut the cord, when the parents are so just a text message away, just a phone call away.
Anyway, you mean?
Yeah.
Is it so? Are you able to kind of 30 years ago you could leave home and kind of find that independence? Is that independent spirit now kind of contracted because of this technology?
That's a great question. It's true. I mean, one wonders whether you can ever get away from it. I guess that's what I hear in your caller, and it is something we have to worry about. I guess for me, the more alarming parts of our story have to do with kids who are disconnected from their parents and who don't have. The support of parents, again, whether financially or emotionally, I'm so much more worried in some ways about young people who are disconnected from parents rather than young people who are kind of overly connected with parents, whether it's their own doing or their parents' doing. But I think these new technologies, as your caller's pointing out, have just really changed how relationships look and feel. And again, we're kind of in a special historical moment to kind of figure out what it all means. Yeah.
Thanks, Adam, for your call. Allison from Clintonville, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
You bet.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay, excellent. I just wanted to say that my situation might not be the same for most of my friends, but my parents have a ongoing understanding with myself and my sisters that regardless of our situation, you know, I'm married, myself and my husband, my sister and my nephew at any time are welcome to take up residence at my parents' house. Like my sister, for example, she lives in California and she just had a baby, you know, my nephew, mm-hmm. and my parents have always made it clear to her that if at any time she wanted a plane ticket and a bedroom, it would be on them, you know.
How old are you, Allison?
I'm 23. My older sister, of whom I'm speaking, is 26, and my younger sister is 18. She just recently moved out of the house.
And why do you think that is, that your parents are like that?
Probably because my mom had a rough early 20s. You know, she herself was a single mom, and she moved in with my grandmother for a short time after her first divorce. So I think they have an understanding of how tough it can be, like situational-wise and financially. So I think that's just something we've always been able to agree on and see each other's side from.
Rick, is that sort of that changing relationship, the shared values and that kind of thing?
I think so. But I think the other point that I hear in the story is that the mother's story, anyway, is that this period of life, and this is a basic fact, this period of life leaves an extraordinary imprint on the rest of your life. And decisions about education, about work, about relationships, they're terribly consequential for what happens later. And those who come through the 20s and come through it well are really able to reap the benefits of that over many decades of life ahead. And those who really struggle in their 20s almost seem destined to struggle for life. And I think, you know, we can't underestimate the power of this decade of life in shaping everything that happens later.
Allison, thanks for your call.
Thanks so much for taking it.
You bet. Bob in Lancaster, welcome to the show.
Hi. I was interested in this conversation for a big reason. Our son, who is not a young person anymore that much, he's in his 40s, has been living with us now for about 6 months, caused mostly by an unfortunate divorce and four kids involved. So we get grandkids part of the time, you know. My understanding is that the judge she walked out, and yet the judge gave her all the perks in this situation.
Well, how is it living with your son?
Well, he's great. There's no problem as far as that part's concerned. He's good to have around, and part of the reason was that he'd lost his job, and just simply, then she forced an early sale of their property. He had a nice property, but she insisted she wanted it sold so she could get the money out of it. Mm-hmm. It's the very first time to sell real estate.
Well, you know, it does make me wonder, Rick Setterston, the whole issue of divorce. I mean, since 1950s, there's been a huge increase in the rate of divorce. And Bob in Lancaster, thanks for your call. You know, that's another factor, isn't that?
Oh, it is. Yeah. I think it's, you know, in the realm of relationships for young people today, there is a kind of fear of divorce. I mean, their parents' lives in particular were heavily marked by divorce. And I mean, one of the ironies is that we really find that young people have not abandoned marriage. They're just delaying it, and they're delaying it with good reason. A lot of that has to do with acquiring higher education and thinking in calculated ways about when to marry and when to parent. But some of that's also about a kind of worry about not wanting to jump too quickly into relationships for fear of divorce. The whole way that young people think today about marriage is dramatically different from before, where, you know, you might have coupled early and then become adults together. Today it's the opposite, that young people think you have to be an adult to get married. And part of it's because they also want to make sure that when they lock in, that they lock in with the right person, that they minimize the risk of divorce. That's a smart thing.
Mike in Westerville, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This is a really fascinating conversation to me, and it's a lot of the people I've heard, they're considerably younger than I am. I'd like to present an idea to your guest and see if you think this isn't a factor. I graduated in the 1960s during the Vietnam War, and at that time, when I was 18, I was a minor. I couldn't buy a drink. I couldn't vote. I couldn't get married without my parents' permission. And all the 18-year-olds in the country were in the same boat. Well, after the war got going, and people started to realize that, hey, you're 18 years old. You can be pulled out of school. You can be sent to Vietnam. You can be crippled or killed. And it's still 3 years before you're an adult. And I think people saw that as being patently unfair, and that changed. And so now 18-year-olds are legally adults. They can enter into contracts. And I think that's something that happened, you know, 40 years ago, 45 years ago, that kind of led down the road to this idea of maybe 18-year-olds not being ready to have a family and a household, but legally they are.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know what your guest thinks about this idea.
Yeah, so I think young people especially feel a kind of disconnect in a way between Well, still a set of injustices, I guess. I mean, that you can be 18 and vote, but not drink until you're 21, right? Like, where's the logic there? But that, you know, you're legally adult in the eyes of the law at 18 or 21, depending on the responsibility we're talking about. But yet socially and psychologically, young people don't feel fully adult until much later. And, you know, that was probably true of earlier generations as well. But I think to the extent that you do have major delays in things like marriage and parenting, it takes young people a longer time to kind of finally feel fully adult. That disconnect was probably there to a great degree then, as your caller is maybe suggesting, but mm-hmm. it's heightened now. I think in a bigger way, I think it's what makes it hard for much older generations, much older than your caller, to really understand what's happening in this period of life, because it looks and feels so different from what they knew. Mm-hmm. When I was young, and point the finger downward and suggest that young people ought to be taking a faster course, where the evidence really shows that, if anything, we have to be most concerned about young people today who go too fast, that a quick marriage is more likely to result in divorce and involve kids, that quick parenting makes it hard to get an education or work full-time or build skill that's going to carry you for the long haul. And as we've been talking about, a quick departure from home before you're ready leaves fewer resources for getting by, let alone for investing in your future. I mean, in so many ways, we ought to be a lot more worried about young people who go too fast than those who are taking their time, even if they're struggling. And some of that's what I hear in your caller's story, too.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for listening. We're going to have to take another break right now. My guest is Richard Setterston. He is the co-author of the book Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513. We'd love to hear your story. We'll get to the calls that are waiting. And we have some emails as well. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, the story of 28,800 rubber duck bath toys that were lost at sea, and what one writer learned about the ocean and ocean junk when he tried to trace them. We hear from Donovan Hone, the author of Moby Duck. Join us.
All that and more on Fresh Air in 20 minutes. It starts at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. And join Frontline for an inside look at the multi-billion dollar business of amateur college sports, including a class action lawsuit that aims to get players a piece of the action. Watch Frontline Money and March Madness. It's tonight at 10 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the spring edition can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.
33 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today, a high near 45. Still cloudy tonight and a low of 29 degrees. Back up to 45 degrees for tomorrow with cloudy skies and still some clouds for tomorrow night, a low again in the upper 20s. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking with Richard Setterston. He is co-author with Barbara Ray of the book Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Phyllis in Worthington, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have some far-reaching things, a little bit off the subject. Not off the subject, but off the 20-year-old subject.
Okay.
One of the things that struck me was the idea that different cultures look at living together, families living together is a little different. My husband's English, so there was a tradition there of families when they were down and out would pull together and people live together. I had that same tradition here. I grew up, I was born during the Depression, and my parents, I remember my aunt and uncle and their kid living in our basement for several months because they didn't have a house to live in anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, you know, other things about the Depression. But the latest version of this family living together was when my son, his wife, and three children put their house on the market because they wanted to move closer to us here in Worthington. And it was the month that the crash, the market fell apart. And so they had moved with us just temporarily while they were looking for a house. Well, they lived with us for 2.5 years, kids 11, 10, 7, and 3.
And wow.
My son, our son, and his wife, my daughter-in-law, I give her tremendous credit because it's pretty tough to live with a mother-in-law, and she did a great job. We had a couple of, you know, discussions at one point, but it's wonderful. I would not have traded that year and a half for anything, and it made us so close. We are so close now. So that's all I had to say.
Well, thank you, Phyllis.
Sure.
Do you find that it actually strengthens a relationship, that it's not only built on economic need and also, you know, relational differences now than it used to be, but it actually can make the relationship stronger, Rick?
Yeah, anecdotally anyway, in so many of the interviews we've done, that seems to be the case. I mean, of course, it's not always true.
Sure.
But I think, you know, when adults live together, they get to know each other in a new way. It's what makes the crafting of a relationship in the 20s with a parent challenging, but also kind of exciting. Because you're coming to know each other more fully as adults. And I think that experience can, in fact, prompt more closeness and create a kind of new shared set of experiences that they carry with them, and I think that's what Phyllis is really pointing to.
This is an email about the negative side of having a 20-something at home, I guess. It's an email from Carl. He writes, how do people stand having their kids home to live after college? They come in at all hours, get drunk or whatever, have their rooms a mess, and think they are old enough to live the way they want. A visit home is enough. They expect food in the fridge and don't realize that a parent can't sleep until they are home late at night.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're not seeing that's typical. Of course, it's the story that gets carried in the media so often.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the spoiled kid, the coddled kid, the self-indulgent kid. You know, it's not to say it's easy at all. But again, like from the vantage point of young people, the support of parents is in our society is probably the biggest factor that distinguishes those who do well from those who don't. And we're not at all saying that young people should be slackers and going slower. We're just saying that there are benefits to going slower, and sometimes that involves living at home. Oftentimes it doesn't. But when young people are sharing their parents' home, you know, it surely taxes them in new ways. And again, it doesn't make it easy for either party. There are no scripts for how parents and kids are supposed to relate as adults, let alone in the same under the same roof, right? Once kids are grown, I think they're crafting something new. So in some cases, that makes it hard.
Now, from Arlen on Facebook, she writes, unless I have this backwards, didn't we humans in general live together for thousands of years? Hasn't the move out, move away mindset only shown up in the past couple hundred years? So in some ways, it isn't this sort of a back to the future. And, mm-hmm. and Rick, it is back to the future, except that now isn't the same as what it was 200 years ago.
Yeah, and it's the very near future, I guess. I mean, so much of this, really, that we've got, this benchmark we've got in our heads really emerged, as I said before, after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the decades before the war, I think it was Phyllis or one of your earlier callers who grew up in the Depression mentioned this. I mean, rates of living with parents were actually much higher mm-hmm. before World War II than they are now. But somehow we have it in our heads that what we're seeing today is somehow brand new and extraordinary and out of control. It's of course, the historical times are different, and the repercussions may be different. The things that drive young people and their parents to live together may be different. But the bottom line is that it's not new. Absolutely.
In an email from Cindy, she writes, "My youngest 25-year-old son and his fiance live with us. He just got a job since graduating from OSU Law School 1 year ago. We love it, but my oldest son says he's not a man." I guess this is the oldest son saying about his brother. "He's not a man and needs to move out. I would like your comments." And also, Rick, when you comment on that, could you address the whole issue of any kind of gender variances you saw, variations in terms of how females and males perceive these kinds of things?
Sure. You know, I think the great thing in Cindy's story is that she's pointing out that her son doesn't find this easy either, right?
Well, this is her older son saying that his younger brother is not a man and needs to move out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, but maybe
this is
maybe
a sibling rivalry situation. Perhaps.
Yes.
I don't know.
but it is something we hear regularly, and that is that young people, and it's not just about living at home. It's just this longer course to adulthood, more generally, leaves young people feeling like they're in an in-between state. Like again, they're clearly no longer children, but they're not quite adults, right? I mean, they feel that, and it's because there's this disconnect between. What young people once used to do and be in this period of life and what they now are, and in not feeling fully like a man, I guess, probably has to do with economic independence. But young people, especially those pursuing professional degrees, even feel this because they're still in school, right? It leaves them feeling like they're not yet fully formed, regardless of how old they are. I think it's an important point because it puts the point also on the child to say that, you know, that this is also not an easy period for them. It's important for parents to recognize that. In their own worry and their own anxiety and their own sorting out of where their kids are.
My guest is Richard Sutterston. He's the director of the Hallie Ford Center for Healthy Children and Families at Oregon State University. He's speaking to us from Oregon right now. If you'd like to speak with him, 614-292-8513. An email from Angel: "The best reason to stay with parents is because students graduate with extreme student loan debt," which you mentioned, Rick. "As far as waiting for jobs, I think they are avoiding jobs that aren't their dream jobs. Overall, this will cost them an income potential." Now, is that what you're finding, that there's also that element, or is that a factor in it for some people, that they're waiting for, you know, the big, you know, the office with the corner window kind of a thing?
Yeah, all right, so
I mean, a corner office with a window. Sorry.
Well, I think young people, especially with college degrees and beyond, I mean, graduate degrees, are wanting to make more careful, strategic decisions about the jobs, especially the first big jobs they jump into. You know, the evidence really does support that there's a lot to be gained in thinking strategically about the jobs you take. We're not really finding that young people are so picky. I mean, in some ways, they're waiting it out. I mean, they're frustrated because they're waiting for a position that's going to be a good fit for who they are and what they're credentialed to do. But they're not abandoning work. But they are frustrated, especially when they have degrees that that position them well to do a particular thing that they can't find a spot for in the market.
Cheryl from Newark, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Richard, I wanted to go back to the caller when you were talking about divorce, and he said that his son had been living with them for 6 months, and the son was just great. And then, and I'm speaking from my own experience, since I moved in with my parents, with my children, when I was divorced. Mm-hmm. And that is a very painful time for this gentleman's son, as we all. Now, it kind of depends on what happened in the divorce. But my point is that I hope that when adult children move in with their parents, the parents will remember that it takes two There are two sides to every argument, and I know that we all love our children, cherish our children. You know, we will go to battle for our children, and yet we're hurting them. We are enabling them. If we don't allow them to understand the responsibility that they had in that divorce, regardless of what the situation is, it's too easy for the parent to take the child's side, and then that child can't grow from that divorce. The most important thing, far and above anything else, to go on with your life is to forgive.
So it can be this opportunity to live with your child again as young adults could be a learning opportunity. Richard, is that, can parents see it that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think her case is probably special. But I think in general there are concerns that young people today are being raised in ways in which they never come to know failure, right? That we protect them so much and invest in them so much, and that we protect them so much that we don't allow them to fall. And I think again, that's not what we're saying. I mean, quite honestly, from my own vantage point, I think failure is a real hallmark of adult life, and especially learning how to be resilient in the face of it. Right, that's key to adult life. And self-esteem goes a long way. We've really built kids up, but but kids also do need to know failure at any age. That so much of what we learn about ourselves and our own capacities and abilities stems from hardship.
And knowing that we can overcome it.
And knowing that we can overcome it. And sometimes knowing that we can't. Both those things. But, you know, the name of the game today is about uncertainty. For all of us, I mean, so many of the things that we're talking about in this book as being characteristic of the early adult years as they're being reformed are also true of other periods of life. I mean, think about it. What it means to be middle-aged today is quite different. What it means to be old, if we even allow ourselves to acknowledge that we become old.
I can't hear you.
That's also being reformed. I think the amazing thing about this historic moment is that every period of life, the whole life course, is being reshaped and restructured, and no one's with a script anymore. And uncertainty is the thing most of all that we will face, and in creating new scripts, and so learning how to be resilient in the face of that is so crucial.
Thank you very much, Cheryl, for that call. And Mike in Lithopolis, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Just a quick background. My parents were high school educated. My mother was 18 when I was born. My father was 21. I attended college, so did my wife. We didn't have our children until I was 28 and 31. My wife was 25 at the time when we had our first child. Two daughters, both of them are college educated, both have their degrees. My older one has her master's degree. They are now 25 and 28. They have both been in what I would call long-term cohabitational relationships, yet neither one of them have children and have not been married at this point. So I guess my question is, I don't know that I necessarily would see a pattern there, but I'm wondering what your guest sees as coming in the future, if this is the way that it has gone over the last three generations.
Well, the median age at marriage is now about 27 for women and about 28 for men. And again, so much of that is driven by exactly the pattern you're talking about. That's about the acquisition of higher ed, right? I mean, it takes time to get degrees, and we got to give people time to get degrees. And the ones who are doing best are the ones who are really, in a very strategic, careful way, postponing marriage and parenting to fill up these years with the acquisition of these credentials. I made some comments before about the new ways in which young people think about marriage, and that especially is that you have to be an adult to get married. And that does now include, for many young people, spouse of cohabitation, which Mike is also pointing to. You know, the model of cohabitation looks pretty different depending on whether you're middle class or working class or low income. For the middle class, and this would be, you know, Mike's daughters, with college educations, I mean, cohabitation usually is a trial run for marriage. There's a growing acceptability of living together. It usually does not involve kids, but it does often end in marriage. For working class and poor young people, especially those without college, you see more what we call serial cohabitation, like spells with different people, often with children, and they usually don't end in marriage. And I don't know if that helps shed some light on Mike's situation, but there clearly is a pattern there.
Thank you, Mike, for that call. You know, one topic we haven't brought up yet is the fact that for some people, having their young adults move back in with them is expensive. They aren't really in a position to help. And I was wondering what your observations are on that, Rick.
Yeah, so this isn't even about living at home. Actually, living at home can save parents money.
If they play the cards right, right. Yeah.
You know, I think even in the 1980s, there's evidence that shows, I may need to say this twice, that about a third of what it costs to raise a kid to 18 came again in the 20s. A third of what it cost to raise a kid to 18 came again in the 20s for parents. And that was in the 80s. The new evidence today suggests that parents are basically tithing with their young adult kids who are under 25. They're giving about 10% of their household incomes each year. Of course, a lot of that's going to college. Some of it's going to maybe underwriting rent and the like, especially if they're in school. But I think the bottom line is that many parents today are not prepared for providing that kind of support. But again, in our society, this is a period of life that's sort of sink or swim, and those who swim today largely swim because of the resources that their parents help provide them with, especially around college. Living at home probably saves parents money in the long haul.
And we only have about a minute left. I'm asking you to cram a lot into one thought, of course. But, there's some institutions out there. You mentioned community colleges, service organizations, and the military that can help with interludes in people's lives.
Yeah, community colleges, all of those institutions and others are really critical. Community colleges in particular, because there are signs of alarm here. About 40% of young people who start four-year degrees do not finish in 6 years, and that's taken to be a breaking point. And they're striking out in university settings. Community colleges are a really important institution to invest in part to help better groom young people to make a jump to a four-year institution, but also because more likely young people who strike out in four-year institutions end up in community colleges.
Anyway. Yeah. Well, Richard Sederston, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much, Ann. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Richard Sederston, he's director of the Hallie Ford Center for Healthy Children and Families at Oregon State University, where he teaches human development and family sciences. He is also a member of the MacArthur Research Network on Transitions to Adulthood, and he's co-author of Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. Thanks again, Rick, and thanks to everybody for your great calls and emails. That's all the time we have. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides on 89.7. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7. NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for WOSU 89.7 comes from the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, presenting Goldie Hawn for the 2011 Keyholder event on May 11th at the Ohio Theater. Tickets and more information online at womensfundcentralohio.org.